Back when I was in university, one of the buildings that I needed to pass through all the time had some artwork by a man who liked to go by the name Mock Escher. And I came to appreciate his artwork. Take a very close look at this picture. What way is up? If you look at different points, you will see that up is on different planes. Now, I'll show you a close-up here of these sentries that are on the perimeter of this building. You notice anything unusual about what's going on there? Okay, well, this man's going up, 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 up. And the other people are going down, 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 down. And again, you take a look at this picture and it's which side is up. There's something very interesting about the book of Genesis. You look at it and God creates what is good. And what does man do? Man gets involved and really messes things up. God makes a very simple promise to Abraham, right? Land, seed, and blessing forever. And what happens? Almost immediately, Abraham tries to give away his wife. Now, that's not going to help the seed promise out very well, is it? And it's not long after that he wants to give her away again. And what does his son do? His son gives his wife away. And then, of course, there was the Abram with Hagar and resulting in Ishmael. We have compromises of the seed that man keeps introducing it. God has a very simple promise, and man just gets in there and kind of messes up. Well, what happened with Isaac? Isaac has two sons. Nice friendly relationship, right? Not so. The father picks the elder son as his favorite. The mother picks the younger son as her favorite. But she had a revelation from God that said that the older would serve the younger. So what happens? Isaac, when it comes time to pronounce a blessing after the birthright has been stolen and after the and as Jacob was about to steal the blessing, he wants to pronounce a blessing, and who does he want to give the Abrahamic blessing to? Esau. But then all of a sudden, when he realizes he's been tricked, he realizes that no, this was really the way that God had wanted it, and the blessing needed to stand. He couldn't say, well, no, Jacob tricked me. But then what happens with Jacob? Jacob has to run away. And as he does so, how many wives and concubines does he end up with? Four. All he's trying to do is marry Rachel, and he ends up with four women. And all the kids are fighting. And all sorts of turmoil, and they are getting involved in the Canaanite religion. They're doing all sorts of things. They end up having a time of deception in order to try to get revenge for Dinah. Man keeps complicating things, doesn't he? Well, here as we enter Genesis chapter 38, the son who has risen to prominence, the one who is now the de facto firstborn because Reuben, Simeon, and Levi have all lost the firstborn status. So now we have Judah. And what does Judah do? He runs away from the family and he marries a Canaanite woman. And it goes downhill from there. The seed promise is always under attack all the way through this book. And God shows himself faithful through the entire book. And Moses is letting the people of Israel who are now in Egypt know God is faithful to his promise. God is faithful even despite the worst efforts of those that have received the promises to mess everything up. Now, this chapter doesn't look like it belongs here. Because if we look at Genesis 37 that we considered over the last 2 weeks, who does Genesis 37 focus upon? Joseph. And Genesis chapter 38 is about Judah. Chapter 39 is about Joseph. 40 is about Joseph. 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, and 50 are all about Joseph. And then we have this one chapter dropped in here after we've started on Joseph, and it is about Judah. But there's an important reason for this chapter needing to be mentioned. And that is that when we turn to Genesis chapter 46, all of the descendants of Jacob that went with him into Egypt are named. They are named based on which of his wives, the sons, or in the case of Dinah, the daughter, were born to him. And so if you look now down at verse 15, these preceding were the sons of Leah, starting in verse 8. Whom she bore to Jacob and Padan Aram, along with bearing his daughter Dinah. All these persons, his sons and his daughters and grandsons and so forth, all of those that moved in Genesis 46 into Egypt that were born to Leah were 33 people. If you count up all of the people other than Jacob, because of course Jacob was not born to Leah, between verses 8 and 15, you end up with 33 people. Now look at verse 10. Verse 12, I mean. The sons of Judah were Er, Onan, Shelah, Perez and Zerah, but Er and Onan died in the land of Canaan. The sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. Genesis chapter 38 is going to mention some of these births. And Genesis chapter 38 is the reason that the tribe that is starting to rise to prominence, the tribe of Judah, instead of having three lines within it, only has one line. Because two of those that were supposed to form subsects within the tribe died. And they died while they were still in the land of Canaan, before they went to Egypt. So when we think about the placement of Genesis chapter 38, these sons that are born, the twins, will reach the age where they will take wives, and they will have sons, and those sons went to Egypt. So Genesis chapter 38 had to happen fairly early in the account. And it's an important thing to set up details that we would have an understanding of how the lineage of Judah has ended up being in the form that it is when they arrive in Egypt. So that is this is a chapter that needs to be in the text, and it's a matter of where to place it, and Moses chose to put it here. Well, let's now look at Genesis chapter 38. And we're going to look at another depressing, dysfunctional family that is disobedient to God. In verses 1 through 11, Judah and his sons compromise the lineage and are disciplined. Whenever we say compromise the lineage, it's either having sexual relations with the wrong people or doing something that will prevent there being a line continuing. And if you think about it, the son Judah here is the de facto firstborn, and it looks like his line is about ready to die out. And Genesis chapter 38 shows how God rescued them despite themselves. Well, in verses 1 through 5, Judah left his brothers to find a Canaanite wife who bore three sons. That should immediately raise red flags, because where did Abraham send the servant in order to get a wife for Isaac? And where was it that Isaac went? Up to the family, up in Haran. But here we have the de facto firstborn. This is the lineage out of which Jesus Christ came, the tribe of Judah, the preeminent tribe of all the tribes. Their lineage, if it had died out, would have been a problem, wouldn't it? Someone else would have had to carry on the lineage. So Judah left his brothers to find a Canaanite wife who bore three sons. Verses 1 through 5. It came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shuah. And he married her and went in to her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And she conceived yet again and bore a son, and called his name Shelah. He was at Kesib when she bore him. So, Judah isn't following the pattern that happened with Isaac. He's not following the pattern that occurred with Jacob. But he's doing more like what Ishmael did, more like what was done by Esau. He marries out of the lineage. And here's the line through which the Messiah is going to come. Notice he takes off from his brothers and he becomes involved with a certain Canaanite woman and he marries her. And so then we note that in the course of time there are three sons that are born, Er, Onan, and Shelah. Now the first two of those are going to die here pretty soon. They will reach adulthood, but they are going to die. In verses 6 through 10, Judah gave Tamar as wife to his first son, and then subsequently to his second son, and they both died childless as a result of evil. In verses 6 through 7, God slew Er, Judah's eldest, because he was evil. We're not told the nature of his evil, but let's read verses 6 and 7. Then Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. Divine discipline. We have here what we would call now the sin unto death. God has taken him out. Notice we aren't told what the nature of his evil was, but God was displeased. God did not want him heading up a division within the tribes of Judah. Well, in verses 8 through 10, God slew Onan, Judah's second son, for violating levirate provisions. And Judah said to Onan, this is the second son, go in to your brother's wife and marry her, and raise up an heir to your brother. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his, and it came to pass, when he went in to his brother's wife, that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, therefore he killed him also. Now, we have looked at the book of Ruth, as you remember, and there we receive some explanation with regard to how the levirate provision worked. The idea was that since the inheritance rites required there to be an heir that would be born, it was important not to leave a lineage with no descendants. It was important that the family tree not have branches that just terminated, but instead to continue the lineages in order that the inheritance rites could take place properly. And the idea here was that Onan would produce a child through her, and that child would not be regarded as his, but it would be regarded as a descendant of Er, the first son. Then if they were to remain married, any subsequent children would be regarded as children of Onan. But what happens to the inheritance rights? Well, they go down through the lineage of Er. Question. Who was the first one born? Er. There are three sons. How are inheritance rights figured out in Israel? You take the three sons and you add one to it. So now you have four inheritance parts. And the firstborn gets two of those parts. And then the second son and the third son each receive one part. So what does that result in? The son that would be produced, that would be regarded as Er's son, has a double inheritance. And what does Onan say? Fooey on that. He says, I'll find someone else to marry. Er's line is over and done with, so now there are just two of us. So if I have children, my children will receive two parts out of three, because you have two children, right? You add one more part, that's three parts, and the firstborn, which now by default with Er being dead, Onan has two parts. And Shelah, the third son, only would have one part. So Onan says, No. I don't want to have any offspring for my brother. Forget this. Dad wants me to do this. God wants me to do this. I don't want to do it. But at the same time, he says, maybe I've got a way that I can accomplish both things. So he used what would be called the withdrawal method. I won't go into details. And the idea there was he wanted to have a sexual relationship, but not to end up having a child born that would be regarded as an heir of heir. How's that? Heir of heir. Now, God said, this is disobedience to what was expected to happen. We don't have any explanation of the levirate practice prior to this, but the fact that it's expected and God expects it, and God chose to take Onan as a result of this disobedience, makes it clear that there was provision. God had explained to them a provision, the levirate provision. Okay, before we go any further, does all of this as to how Onan is thinking make sense? Does the inheritance regulations that they were under make sense? Okay. Now, some related topics. Onanism is often used, misused as far as a term for autoeroticism. I don't think I need to explain the term, do I? Okay. But that's not what Onan did. What Onan did was to use the withdrawal method. Not a very effective method of birth control, but that is what he used in order to try to evade having a son that would be regarded as heir's son, who would have the double inheritance compared to his own subsequent children. A lot of people have then said out of this that God is saying in this passage that he's against birth control. Does this passage say anything about birth control in general? No. What it's talking about is that there were inheritance rights that were going to be passed on through children that would be regarded as descendants of each of the sons subsequently. The first son born to Onan would be regarded as born to heir. Since God was seeking to protect inheritance rights, there was an expectation that a child was going to be born. Try not to have a child when God says, have a child, is disobedience. But this says nothing about whether or not birth control is allowable. The Bible is silent on that topic. It's one of those, shall we say, doubtful things. Scripture does not make a pronouncement on birth control. Now, about the other issue that gets raised on this, on autoeroticism. Text doesn't exactly say anything about it, but I'd like for you to turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. 1 Corinthians 7 says some things that I think are pertinent to that issue. Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. This is talking about a man that is not married to the woman that is mentioned here. And the type of touching he's talking about is that which arouses sexually. And he says, that is not to be done. It is only to be within the bounds of marriage. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The issue here is husbands are to seek to please their wives sexually. Wives are to seek to please their husbands sexually. Verse 4, the wife does not have authority over her own body. Well, if she did, autoeroticism would be something allowable. She doesn't have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Once again, that rules out autoeroticism for the men. So verse 4 is probably the clearest statement that we have in the text about that particular issue, other than that we have other passages that make it clear. For example, Jesus says not to look after a woman with lust in one's heart, because that is the same as having committed adultery with her already. It's only indirectly that the text deals with this particular issue. But I think that it does make a clear enough set of statements in verse 4 to make the issue clear. Okay, end of digression. Let's now go back to Genesis chapter 38. God has slain Er for evil that is unspecified. God also slays Onan for, although he had sexual relations with Tamar, he sought to prevent a child from being born at a time that a child was supposed to be born, and that was disobedience. In verse 11, Judah becomes fearful. Judah says, hey, this isn't working out too well. Each of my sons that marries Tamar ends up dead. I kind of like my third son. So he says, I don't know if I really want him to marry her. However, he tells Tamar that when he's of age, he will issue the order for him to perform the levirate. But instead, Judah disobediently failed to provide his third son for the levirate, putting his own selfish interests ahead of continuing a lineage. Here Judah is with one son, and he's already seen that God has taken sons for disobedience. So what does he do? He says, well, yeah, when he gets old enough. But he never gets around to ordering the levirate provision. Verse 11. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. For he said, lest he die like his brothers. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So Judah is pretending that he is going to follow the requirement. But a lot of time elapses. And Shelah becomes old enough. And he gets older. And he gets older. And he gets older. And Tamar is saying, hey, what's going on here? So in verses 12 through 23, Tamar comes to realize that Judah has lied about providing his third son as a levirate. So she pretended to be a prostitute, causing Judah to function as levirate. Verse 12, Judah's wife, Shua, that was mentioned in verse 2, she died. The time of mourning passed, and Judah went up with Hira, that's the man that he went to visit in verse 1 and to live near. He went up with Hira to Timnah to shear sheep. Verse 12. Now in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. So when he once again leaves the family household, after his wife has died and after the time of comfort or after the time of mourning, then it sets up an occasion where Tamar is going to seek to force his hand and to make it so that the leveret is performed, even though Judah had no intention of giving his son Shelah to her. So in verses 13 through 15, Tamar realized that Judah would not provide his third son as a leveret. So she dressed up as a prostitute so that he, Judah, would be the leveret. Verses 13 through 15. And it was told Tamar, saying, "Look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place, which was on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot because she had covered her face. Now remember, what we were told at the beginning of this chapter, in verse 1, was that when Judah left his familiar circumstances and he left his brothers, then all of a sudden he starts having interest in Canaanite girls. His wife has died, period of time has elapsed, and he's going to be going down the road, and she thinks, maybe history is going to repeat itself. So she goes, and she dresses up, puts on a veil, makes it look like she is a temple prostitute. And when he saw her, he didn't recognize her because her face is covered. She looks like a harlot. And he thought that she was a harlot. Verses 16 through 19. Then he turned to her by the way and said, "Please let me come in to you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" And he said, "I will send a young goat from the flock." So she said, "Will you give me a pledge till you send it? Give me some security here." Then he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" So she said, "Your signet and cord and your staff that is in your hand." Then he gave them to her and went in to her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away and lay aside her veil and put on the garments of her widowhood. She figured history would repeat itself and that once he got away from the family that he would be up to his old tricks. And sure enough, that is the case. He figures he's away from family. Nobody knows what he's doing. He's all by himself. He's out on a business trip. He can do whatever he wants. Lord was watching, though, wasn't he? And he's not quite so anonymous as he thinks, because he's given indications. He's given indications that his character is not quite up to what one might hope for, because his daughter-in-law has picked up on something about him. So, he goes and he obviously doesn't have any sheep with him. He doesn't have anything to give to her. So she says, I basically want your credit card and your driver's license and so on and so forth. And he says, yeah, sure. So he hands all of his credit cards and everything else over to her. Signet ring basically is what you use for signing documents. I mean, he's basically given her quite a bit there just to make sure that he ends up delivering the kid. So then once he's passed, she trashes those garments and goes back, dresses like a widow, and returns to life as normal. Well, then in verses 20 to 23, Judah started thinking about his lost credit card and figured I better hurry up and get a kid goat over there. And so in verses 20 to 23, Judah could not find her to give the kid. So she kept his seal and staff. And Judah sent the young goat by the hand of his friend the Adullamite, that's Hira, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he did not find her. Of course he didn't find her. She returned to home and she's not wearing the garments that she had then. She's back in her garments of widowhood. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, where is the harlot that was openly by the roadside? And they said, there was no harlot in this place. So he returned to Judah and said, I cannot find her. Also the men of the place say that there was no harlot in this place. Then Judah said, well, let her take them for herself, lest we be shamed. For I sent this young goat, and you have not found her. So basically Judah says, well, so much for trying. I guess my credit card's out there. I don't know who to call to get it canceled. I guess she's got it. He said, I'm not going to make worse fool of myself by continuing to hunt for her, because then people will start talking about, you know, why is he looking for this harlot? Well, 3 months elapses. And in verses 24 to 26, Judah learned that Tamar was pregnant, and he ordered her to be burned. But she proved that he was the father. So he admitted that he was in the wrong and she was in the right. Verses 24 to 26. And it came to pass about 3 months after that Judah was told, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. So Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. And she was brought out, or when she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the men to whom these belong, I am with child. And she said, please determine who these are, the signet and the cord and staff. So Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah, my son. And he never knew her again. Now, Judah has not said she was righteous, has he? He said she's more righteous than he was, because he has violated what he knows that God had commanded. What a double standard, though. Let her be burned. And Judah didn't think there were any consequences. I mean, it was just fine from his standpoint. Just lost his credit card. But he recognizes the signet, the cord, and the staff. And he knows that there's only one way that she got it. And he can think back to that day, and he knows that she can explain, and all of a sudden, the timetable, everything works out in such a way that everybody would know Judah was the father of that child. So, she is forced Judah's hand. Judah has ended up, because of his proclivity towards sexual relationships outside of marriage, to end up fulfilling the leveret when he would not allow his third son to do so. So, what is the result of all of this? Verses 27 through 30. Tamar bore twins. The hand of the secondborn, Zerah, appeared first, but Perez was the first to be born. Now it came to pass at the time for giving birth, so another 6 months have passed, that behold, twins were in her womb. And so it was, when she was giving birth, that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, "This one came out first." Then it happened, as he drew back his hand, that his brother came out unexpectedly. And she said, "How did you break through? The breach be upon you." Therefore, his name was called Perez, or breach. Don't ask me to explain how this happened. This is obviously a miracle. The same God that was able to produce children through Abraham and Sarah, especially when Sarah was as old as she was, the same God that is able to have our Messiah be born of a virgin is capable of having somehow one child with a hand going first, which is not the normal appendage to come out first. Somehow it happened, and I don't doubt it happened, but I don't know how to explain it except God was involved. But she bore the twins, and notice the one was marked as being firstborn, and he didn't come out first. But isn't it reminiscent of how Jacob reached for Esau's heel? And what's going to end up happening is the second one born is going to be the one that is going to be the dominant of the two sons, and the one through whom the messianic line goes. All the way through Genesis, what have we seen? God has done all sorts of unexpected things, has he not? Many times God has preferred the younger of the children through whom the lineage goes. And we even have some Canaanite blood in Jesus Christ because of the because of Tamar. Very interesting things as far as how God works. God is able to rescue situations after man has made an absolute mess. When God makes a promise, God is going to deliver on it. And we see his faithfulness. And Moses is seeking to explain to Israel just how faithful God is. At the same time, it was important for them to know why it was that Judah did not start out with three lines. That is, three lines having descendants. Because the leveret was actually performed by Judah, not by one of the sons, and it didn't end up with three lineages being preserved, but only one. So when we go to Genesis chapter 46, verse 12, the sons of Judah were Er, Onan, Shelah, Perez, and Zerah. Of course, the latter two are grandsons, in a sense, at one level, but they're also directly sons of Judah, but through a wife that was actually started out as the wife of Er. So in one sense, sons, in another sense, third generation. The sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul, and they end up being old enough that they are part of the 33 descendants of Leah that went into Egypt. God is faithful. Man keeps making a mess of it. You know, you look at these pictures, God can have something that makes perfect sense, and man can make something that ends up spiraling out of control if it weren't for God taking control after man has messed things up. All the way through here, we have seen an extremely dysfunctional family. Ever since we started looking at Abraham. But God made promises. And God's going to keep his promises. I am glad that that is my God. Because as I look at my own life, God is the only reason that I have a future. And let's be honest, he's the only reason any of us have a future. Because he is faithful to his promises. Any questions about this passage? Yeah, it's... They could make a soap opera about this family. And the real hero would have to be God. I would assume that there was. I would assume that there was at least one sin, probably more. And notice, Judah did not say she was righteous. He said she was more righteous than he. Yeah, if you haven't spent much time in Genesis, you probably weren't expecting some of the things that we've ended up having to discuss. Narratives in the Bible are interesting. But all the way through, we always see God's faithfulness despite man's unfaithfulness. And I would have to say this. One very good argument for the Bible being inspired, the heroes aren't really heroes, are they? When someone makes up a story, they make themselves out to be just absolutely wonderful. And you'd never imagine that the person ever lifted their voice or, you know, did anything wrong. And the heroes, we see them with all their problems. And they have many of them, and they are serious ones. And Israel lived with the consequences of these problems. They kept repeating themselves and going on. And God kept having to discipline and deal with him in all sorts of ways. But God was faithful to the promises that he had made. He is able to discipline and at the same time keep unconditional promises. And that is so encouraging. Never lose sight, though. The God who keeps his promises also is a holy God, and he does know how to discipline.